This is Aspire, Arch Street Public Radio, a content-driven platform broadcasting interviews from our Innovate, Innovate Media, Innovate CSR, and Innovate Under 30 podcast series. Aspire gives public voice to socially conscious and forward-thinking leaders within the nonprofit and for-profit sectors, academia, journalism, and social entrepreneurship.
My name is Robert Rim, Managing Editor for Arch Street Press. I'll be your host today. Today our guest is Wayne Pacelli, President and CEO of the Humane Society of the United States, the country's largest animal protection organization. The Humane Society and its affiliates provide direct care to more than 100,000 animals each year. They confront the largest national and international issues facing animals, coming to the aid of those in crisis and attacking the root causes of the problems. Wayne received his BA in History and Studies in the Environment from Yale University in 1987. Prior to joining the Humane Society, he served as the executive director of the Fund for Animals from 1988 to 1994. He was also the associate editor and later president of the board for the Animals Agenda magazine, as well as a guest instructor for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Refugee Training Academy. He's on the boards of the Humane Society Wildlife Land Trust, Humane Society International, the South Florida Wildlife Center, Global Animal Partnership, and Humane USA. He co-founded the National Federation of Humane Societies in 2006 and serves on their board. He also founded Humane USA and the Humane Society Legislative Fund. Wayne became president and CEO of the Humane Society in 2004 after serving for nearly 10 years as their chief lobbyist and spokesperson. Wayne, great to have you with us today.
Thank you for having me on. Delighted to be with you.
Did you have any child experiences that inspired your love for animals?
You know, in my first book, The Bond, I wrote a bit about this, and my thesis in the book is that we humans are connected to animals. It's not unusual or odd for people to feel a connection with animals, and I argued that there's even some biochemistry to the bond, that we as a social animal ourselves need interactions with others. Of course, people provide a lot of that socializing need for us, but animals are a big part of the equation. You know, we humans have been around in some form for a couple of million years, and for 99% of human history, we were immersed in nature as tribal societies, and those tribal societies knew about all the animals in the forests and the fields, and they also knew a lot about the plants and the entire biotic community. So I say that just as background to indicate that when I was a kid, I loved animals and had an instinct and passion, you know, to be good to them and to be fascinated by them. And I think so many of us share that. I had no singular experience that was defining for me, you know, as a kid. I just had this natural inclination for animals. And E.O. Wilson, the Harvard biologist, talks about, you know, us being drawn to other life forms. He calls it biophilia. And, you know, just like a moth is drawn to a flame, we are drawn to animals. And that was always my instinct. It was always my worldview. It was just the way I've been constructed.
And because of that construction, as it were, did you always intend to pursue a profession that involved helping animals?
I had no idea there were groups that were devoted to this issue. I mean, I was so naive as a kid.
Yeah.
And I like to tell a story that my uncle, who was a wonderful lover of animals, he wanted to get dogs for me and my siblings and then my cousins. We had a large extended Italian and Greek family. And he got dogs from a pet store for us. Our dog was named Randy, and he got she was a West Highland Terrier, and he got West Highland Terriers from my cousins too, Mandy, Candy, and Sandy. So they were all rhymed names. And you know, from our front doorstep in New Haven, Connecticut, it was just a quarter mile to the local police precinct. We didn't have a local Humane Society or SPCA, but the city police served the animal care and control function. I didn't think even then, and I heard these dogs barking all the time, I didn't make the connection to go adopt a dog from there. So my uncle went to a pet store, and Randy, we had her paper, she was from Kansas, we were, you know, we were quite intrigued by that. We didn't know anyone from Kansas, but Randy was from Kansas. Later in life, as an adult, I realized that Kansas was a center for the puppy mill industry. So we got a dog from more than 1,000 miles away via a pet store in the community and contributed to the puppy mill problem. And we could have gotten a dog from the local animal care and control and saved a life. And, you know, for me, that always is stuck in my mind. I loved animals. My uncle loved animals. But we made the wrong choices because we weren't informed. And you know, I just think that so many people don't know what's going on with animals. And one of the things I try to do in my life today is connect people and to connect them with information, connect them with resources, so they can make the right choices.
Sure. And you also, through the Humane Society, confront really the root causes of some of the largest problems facing animals, not only nationally but internationally, sometimes tackling issues that local shelters don't have the reach or the resources to address. So what are some of these problems and how do you deal with them?
Well, a lot of people, when you think of animal protection, they think of, you know, animal sheltering or animal rescue. Those are critical and noble pursuits, and we do a lot of it at the Humane Society of the United States. But if we did just that, we would simply be addressing the symptoms. I mean, once animals are in crisis, once they're out on the street, once they're in trouble, you've kind of already lost part of the battle, and now you're kind of salvaging things or you're conducting a rescue operation. Most of the animals that are used in society are caught up in big economic activities, like the production of animals for food, or the use of animals in science, or the use of animals in wildlife management, or fashion, or the use of animals in entertainment. So we at the Humane Society are trying to re-envision our human relationship with animals and build a better society that takes into account the needs of other creatures. And we, you know, call upon public policymakers, you know, whether lawmakers in Congress or in the state legislatures or in local government, to create standards in society to protect animals from, you know, human-caused cruelty and exploitation. And we're asking corporations, whether they're big food retailers or food producers, to make better choices, or to ask cosmetic companies not to test on animals when they have viable alternatives to do risk assessment for chemicals and compounds and cosmetics that they may be marketing to the public. In all of these different realms in our society, animals are caught up in our economy, and we're trying to change the way that this economy works so that if animals are part of the business model of these operators, they do better by them, and that takes many varying forms.
And you mentioned corporations. Are they generally receptive, or do they fight back?
Well, you know, I was a college student at Yale, and I started an animal advocacy group in the 1980s. And, you know, I would say, looking back, that, you know, I almost felt we were a protest movement. We were just trying to raise the issue. We were trying to be part of the conversation. We were trying to socialize the public to the idea that animals matter and that, you know, we should take intentional action, even when it comes to big sectors of the economy like food and agriculture, and do better for animals. It's been amazing in the last 20 years, in particular the last 4 or 5 years, to see the changes that have been wrought. I mean, in the last 6 months, we've negotiated agreements with 120 of the biggest food retailers, from McDonald's to the, you know, grocery chain Kroger to family restaurants like IHOP or Cracker Barrel. They're now changing their purchasing practices for the animal products that they use to serve the public. So, for instance, 300 million laying hens in the United States produce more than 90 billion eggs a year. The average American eats 260 eggs a year. Many of them are hidden in baked goods or pastas or products where you don't really quite realize that you're consuming an egg. The big moral problem with the egg industry has been that the laying hens are jammed. They're crowded together in small cages called battery cages.
Yeah, which we see images of all over the place.
Yeah, six or eight birds jammed into an area about the size of a large microwave. And the average space per bird is about two-thirds the size of an 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper. That's where they live without any escape, without any relief for 12 to 18 months before they're no longer productive and then they're sent off to slaughter. I mean, you know, whether you're an inveterate, you know, animal product consumer, carnivore, egg eater, milk drinker, or you're a vegan or a vegetarian, wherever you are on the spectrum, I mean, that is a moral problem. I mean, the idea that animals built to move are immobilized for their entire lives, I mean, it's a horror. I've been on these farms. I've seen these animals crowded together. I mean, to think that we could do that to these creatures just because, you know, we're able to exert that sort of control over them, I mean, that's an example of human license, not human responsibility. And what we're doing is working with these companies now, and I guess to circle back to your question, are companies responding? Finally, yes. I mean, it's been a long slog, but we're seeing big changes, and all of these changes are really chronicled in my book, The Humane Economy. You know, and my thesis in this second book of mine is that we've got to marry our business and our commerce with our values. When you disassociate them, you get bad outcomes for the whole of society, and as applied to animals, you get horrible cruelty and exploitation. And, you know, consumers are finally waking up, I think, you know, thanks to the work of the Humane Society of the U.S. and other organizations in our field, alerting people to these moral problems and calling upon decent-minded people to drive changes in the political realm, in the corporate realm, and that's slowly what's happening. It's exciting to see, finally.
Yeah, and you mentioned intentional action, and the Humane Society provides direct care, provides rescue, provides services for animals in crisis. So how is the Humane Society equipped to respond both quickly and efficiently to those in immediate need?
Well, you know, it's a big country and it's a big world, and we're just one group, so we can't do everything. Fortunately, in our 3,100 counties in the United States, you know, many of them have either a private Humane Society or SPCA or a public agency like an animal care and control operation. So there are lots of local groups and agencies that do important work. We do a number of things. We go into some of the most impoverished communities in the U.S., so in the inner cities where people are in certain zip codes living below the poverty line, or we go to Indian reservations or other of the most rural areas where people are in poverty, and we provide and bring services to people and the animals they care about. We also have a kind of a roving animal rescue team, so we respond to crises that exist that are kind of beyond the ability and resources of the local groups to deal with. So, for instance, we just did a raid of a puppy mill in northwest Arkansas with 295 dogs in terrible distress. You know, most of these local groups, I mean, they just don't have the capacity to handle 300 animals in a severe health situation. We do, and our teams respond to those crises, as well as, you know, breaking up dog fights or cock fights or responding to animal hoarding cases where someone has a psychological disorder and they've acquired animals in such numbers that they lose control of the situation, don't even realize that the animals are starving or they're dying as a consequence of disease and inattention to, you know, just the most basic medical issues. We also do this work internationally. You know, if you go to India or you go to Bangladesh or you go to certain parts of South America, dogs are roaming all over the streets. They don't have the animal care system and programs that we now have in the United States, where you don't have animals roaming all over the place. And, you know, roaming animals are a threat. It's a threat to them and their health and well-being. They can be struck by cars. They could be hurt by people who have the wrong intentions or who feel resentful. You know, they may be involved in public health issues. There could be dog bite issues. Occasionally you get a rabies outbreak. So we now have street dog programs throughout India. We're starting them in Bangladesh. We've been in Bhutan. We've been in the Philippines, where we humanely manage these populations. We capture the dogs, sterilize them right there on the ground in a surgically appropriate way where we're paying attention to the basic rules of veterinary science, and we release the animals back into their environment. So there are no shelters, you know, for this number of animals. There are not homes for this number of animals, but we vaccinate them to give them a better chance, and we sterilize them so they don't produce more animals and perpetuate this cycle. So, you know, we also have wildlife rehabilitation centers. We operate the largest one in the U.S. in South Florida. We also have one in Massachusetts. We've got one in San Diego County in California. So our animal care work is diverse. We also do humane wildlife management work, like contracepting wild horses. In the West, the ranchers feel they're too numerous and they want the horses removed. This is a humane way to control the population. We do that with deer in suburban areas and lots of other animals as well.
And you mentioned the locally and state-based groups, and the Humane Society makes sure that existing laws are properly enforced, and also works to pass local, state, and certainly federal laws to protect animals. And just as a point of reference, the organization has seen the passage of over 500 new state laws since 2005 and has helped to pass more than 25 federal statutes to protect animals since then. So what are some of the campaigns and investigations that the Humane Society has led, and what legislative action did you see as a result? Maybe one or two examples of that.
So, well, certainly puppy mills, these large-scale dog breeding operations that confine the breeding mothers as they kind of churn out puppies for the pet trade. They're sold through various channels, typically through pet stores or over the internet. So we've campaigned for, you know, federal rulemaking to have stricter standards for the care of these animals at the breeding sites. We've done state legislative work. We've gotten a number of pet stores to convert to a rescue model, like PetSmart and Petco, the largest two chains that exist in the pet supply and pet industry, 2,500 stores between them. 20 years ago, they decided no longer to sell dogs from these mills and instead to throw open the doors of their stores to rescue groups and shelters that have homeless animals, and it's been an incredible sort of boon. So I'd say puppy mills is one campaign. Another campaign that's a wildlife campaign is our campaign to end the commercial slaughter of seals in Canada, the largest marine mammal slaughter in the world. When we took it on in 2005, 400,000 seals killed just a couple of weeks after these white-coated seals are born. Men come in ships and club them and shoot them and then peel their skin off, their fur, to sell to the international fur trade. It's not a subsistence hunt. It's a global part of the fur industry. And we've dropped that hunt down by 90% by closing markets all over the world. So we got the European Union to ban imports of seal products from any country. And, of course, this applies to Canada. And we've worked in Canada to raise awareness about this issue. But the main thing we've done is close markets all over the world that's dropped pelt prices and really given these sealers little incentive to go out and kill the seals.
And you mentioned the national chain stores. So that was that public pressure that caused them to change their policies? Was it enlightened top executives? You know, what do you attribute that kind of change, which is really huge?
Yeah, you're referring to the PetSmart and Petco.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I think it was really awareness, and I think that these companies, and this is really a core argument in my book, that the companies can do better by doing right by animals. And there's data to show that when you adopt a dog from a PetSmart or Petco, homeless animals that are brought in through one of the local rescue groups or shelters, you're going to spend five times as much as a regular customer at the store. I mean, you get such a psychic sort of high from meeting this new family member and wanting to kind of give this homeless animal, you know, comfort and protection and nourishment, and a safe, soft bed, that people are spending more at the store. So the companies realize, okay, we can shed all of the protests, we can prevent litigation, we can also then connect people to our value system and have them realize that PetSmart and Petco is your friend. They're doing something good for animals. And then you have loyalty to the company. You may have gotten your dog there. It's a better business outcome. And, you know, I really believe that animal cruelty baked into the business model is a drag on performance. You know, I think of SeaWorld. We recently announced an agreement with SeaWorld that's going to end its breeding of orcas. It's going to end the theatrical shows with orcas. It's going to commit to more of a rescue and rehabilitation model for its daily operations. And, you know, SeaWorld was struggling. There was a film that exposed many questionable practices at the company. And now that they are really putting animal welfare more in the center of who they are as a company, the stock price in the last 10 days has gone up about, 22%. You know, it's good business to do right by animals. And that's really what I argue in my book, The Humane Economy, that those companies that are attached to old school thinking when it comes to animals are going to be left behind in an ever-changing economy. And those companies that are really building animal welfare as a core value of the company are going to soar. You know, we as a nation made a transition many years ago from whaling, where ships would leave from New Bedford and Nantucket and kill whales, to supply, you know, a growing economy with whale oil as fuel. We moved away from that, and now we have whale watching as a multi-billion dollar industry where we can have people who can watch a whale over and over and over again. You're not depleting the whale population by watching them. And the market for people today, because now we figured out other ways to get energy other than killing whales and extracting the oil from them, we can have energy production that doesn't involve direct exploitation of the biggest animals that have ever lived on the planet, and we can now appreciate these animals in their native habitats, and we can monetize the experience by having a wildlife watching excursion on one of these boats. It's a remarkable thing.
Yeah, and it makes such intrinsic sense, and this really applies to all businesses, doesn't it, well beyond animals, doing well by doing good?
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, especially with an educated, informed, you know, constituency and consumer base. You know, Steven Pinker wrote a book called The Better Angels of Our Nature. He said, we're getting better as a society. You know, we do hear about lots of violence in our communities. We hear about war. But overall, if you look across the range of problems that we have in society, violence is going down. We're becoming more compassionate. We're attending to groups that were not really part of the political process, that weren't properly attended to. And I think animals are part of that arc that exists for us as a society. Better treatment, more compassion. We've been disconnected from some forms of this exploitation. I mean, these factory farms where we raise these animals for food or eggs or milk, I mean, the conditions on many of them are deplorable. And one reason that have developed is that there was not, you know, a powerful presence like the Humane Society of the United States to expose these problems. And people were disassociated, you know, from their daily food choices and what was actually happening to the animals. We're closing that gap, and more conscious consumers want to do the right thing. They don't want to be associated with battery cage confinement of hens or keeping a pig in a crate where she can't even turn around for 3 years. I mean, this is not acceptable if you feel that animals, you know, feel pain and they suffer, and they shouldn't be subjected to this sort of routine and customary exploitation.
This Innovate series features dialogue with some of the most influential advocates for changing our world, from the CEOs and founders of major nonprofits to the directors of cultural and academic institutions. Innovate demonstrates the vital role of empathy as an agent for that change. Innovate and Aspire are produced in partnership with Ashoka, Innovators for the Public, the Kellogg Fellows Leadership Alliance, and the Philadelphia Social Innovations Journal, and presented by Arch Street Press and the Public Radio Exchange. We now return to our Innovate interview with Managing Editor Robert Rim and Wayne Pacelli, President and CEO of the Humane Society of the United States.
And you mentioned the political process. You've testified before the House, the U.S. House and Senate committees on really a wide range of animal protection issues. So what were some of the most pressing problems you've spoken about?
Well, animal fighting was one. I've worked to upgrade with, of course, the lawmakers who did the work, but we really put the issue on their radar screen and then lobbied the issue to make dog fighting and cock fighting a federal felony, to ban possession of fighting animals, to ban the trade and the implements that are attached to the animals, to enhance the violence. Like with cock fighting, the cockfighters strap on short knives or long knives to the bird's legs. The short knife is about 1 inch. The long knife is 2 to 3 inches. And that's what really produces the cutting and the killing. Otherwise, the birds would be fighting for hours. This way, you can deliver a lung shot or a heart, stabbing, pretty quick in a cockfight. So we've made that a crime in every single state. We've made it a federal crime. I've testified on issues from, the killing of bison in Yellowstone National Park to the practice of bear baiting on our national forests, where people hunt, trophy hunters put out food for bears and lure them in and shoot them while they're feeding, which I think is unsporting and unacceptable. It's really just a huge range of issues. Right now we've got on the docket in Congress the first ever federal anti-cruelty statute. The states have anti-cruelty statutes. We want a federal statute. We've got a bill to help with women shelters and building some animal sheltering capabilities at these women's shelters, because in a lot of domestic violence situations, and because pets are in so many homes, the abuser threatens the woman by threatening to harm the animal. And it's often what keeps a woman in a domestic violence setting, because she thinks if she leaves, the guy's going to injure or kill the dog or the cat. And if women can get out of there with their animal, it's a safer outcome for them, of course, and for the animal.
And how receptive do you think the government is to protecting animals?
It depends. I mean, there's a lot of excuse making with animals. There is a lot of old-style thinking. Clearly, we've been educating lawmakers at all levels of government to the needs of animals and activating our constituency to show them that there is an enormous and growing voting bloc that's concerned about these issues. I think that if there's a big force on the other side, say like the NRA, if we're trying to stop captive hunting where people shoot animals in fenced enclosures for a fee and a guaranteed kill arrangement, and there are thousands of these operations in the U.S., we make the intellectual case, but then some of the lawmakers are beholden to the NRA and they won't act. Or on agriculture issues with confinement, we actually had an agreement with the egg industry, the trade association for the egg industry, to lift the standards for the protection of laying hens. But the rest of the farm lobby, the cattle producers, the pig producers, were so concerned about any animal welfare standard in agriculture, they worked to thwart that legislation. So the special interests, whether it's the gun and hunting lobby or the farm lobby, will often work to thwart sensible, popularly supported legislation. But we're fighting through it, and reform has a funny way of finding a channel to advance. And the example there with the egg industry, the Congress did not ratify the deal we made with the egg industry to improve the conditions for the hens. So we went to the corporations, the big sellers, the Krogers, the McDonald's, and others, and now they've all embraced our agenda. In fact, they have exceeded the congressional standard that was being proposed, and they're all going cage-free, and they're all phasing in these cage-free purchases over the next few years. So, we work through all different channels to drive reform. And my book, when you see it in its whole, and you look at the different gains that have been made in different industries, food and ag and science and wildlife management fashion, it's quite remarkable. We're in an extraordinary moment of change. We're in at an inflection point in terms of our relationship with animals. It doesn't mean that we should rest on our laurels, but we're making progress, and I think that progress begets more progress on these issues.
Which is great to hear, and you mentioned your work as a lobbyist for the Humane Society. Did that directly help you transition into your role as president and CEO?
I think so. You know, if you're CEO of an organization as complex as this one, you've got to be able to move in a number of different domains, obviously fundraising and accounting and balancing budgets, but also some of the other practical things that we do as an advocacy organization, like driving lawmaking or working with the biggest corporations or the smallest corporations in the U.S. So, you know, I really became a bit of a change agent through my history of working on the ground for animals. And, you know, I think that animal advocates want to know the leader of an organization is not just a bean counter, is not just a manager, but really has a passion and a drive for the issues. And that's what I've got. I mean, I come to work every day thinking, you know, how can I make this world a better one for animals? And I've done so many of these things on the ground, from rescue to lobbying to, you know, working with the biggest CEOs, biggest companies with CEOs, you know, who are willing to talk about these issues for a long time. And I hope and I think I've brought a real ethic of effective action, that we are really changing the world for animals here. And, you know, it's not just us and our 1,000 staff members. I mean, it's getting people who are members of our organization active and engaged. I mean, we want people who care about animals to join the Humane Society of the United States, go to humanesociety.org, become a member, get involved in our cause. I mean, we are really changing things. You look at the history of our country, you know, we had a lot of social and moral problems. You know, everything from slavery to denying women the right to vote to civil rights violations. I mean, we're a better country because we fought some of these battles. We have a battle to stop animal cruelty, and it's a very complex battle that leads us into many different realms of industry and the use of animals, you know, being routine in so many sectors of the economy. We're turning that around because we think we've got a winning formula. You know, when you're better to animals, you have better outcomes throughout the whole of society. I think our work proves that.
And it surely is a complex battle. The Humane Society and the Humane Society International, very complex organizations. Given that, do you see yourself as a social entrepreneur?
I think so. You know, in some ways, I mean, I'm a nonprofit, you know, executive, and you know, it's really not directly about our business, and it's certainly not about making money. It's really about influencing all of the other institutions in society. I think that we rely, you know, on social entrepreneurs in so many ways, and we have them, you know, within our organization and as members of the organization. It's really about social change, and that happens through many different channels, and business is one of those channels.
And the Humane Society International, which is your global affiliate, it runs programs in more than 20 countries. So maybe you could just talk briefly about the international arm of the Humane Society.
Yeah, and we're growing rapidly. We're now touching 56 countries, and we're going to get to 75 soon. You know, we live in a global economy. Communications are global. Transportation is global. You know, we cannot treat the United States alone as the field of battle. You know, you can stop a major hog factory confinement facility from setting up shop in Arizona, and they can move over to Mexico. You haven't solved an animal welfare problem by simply, you know, pushing that problem to some other country. So it's a global problem of animal cruelty, and that is the field of battle upon which we operate. And our Humane Society International is working in Europe. It's working in Asia. I mean, we have an office in India that is doing incredible work. We're, you know, active in Latin America and South America, Africa, all over the world. And what is remarkable, which is something I mentioned earlier in our interview, is that this human-animal bond exists everywhere. It's not something that exists just among Westerners or, you know, among any class of people or race of people, not, you know, reserved for women as opposed to men. All of us have a connection to animals. Some of us feel it more strongly than others, and it's not determinative. I mean, you know, through human agency and by educating ourselves and by, you know, really calling ourselves to live in a way that is, you know, purposeful and intentional, I mean, we need to make the right choices in life. But I think we have a bit of a head start because of this bond that's within us, and I see it all over the world. I see South Africans having it. I see Indians having it. I see people in Bangladesh and, you know, people in Peru and Argentina. It's incredible. It doesn't mean that we don't have immense challenges. It doesn't mean that we don't face ignorance. It doesn't mean that we don't confront entrenched interests who want to keep the status quo. But, you know, we've got something to build upon, and that is hopeful to me.
And it's great to hear about that hope. So looking toward the future, what does that hold for the Humane Society of the United States? What would you ideally like to see happen?
Well, we want to really have people understand that animals have their own lives. They have their own families. They have a will to live that is just as strong as our will to live. They are not our equals in terms of intellectual capacity or the capacity to change the environment or the world, but they are our equals when it comes to suffering. And that is really, you know, the most morally relevant criterion when it comes to our dealings with them. And given that it's the 21st century, we have this incredible human mind, all of this creativity and ingenuity that we're capable of. Let's use our brilliant minds to figure out a way for us to lead good lives and productive lives as citizens of our societies, but not leave a trail of animal victims in the process. I mean, we can gain sustenance by not eating meat that comes from factory farms. You know, in fact, if we eat mostly plant-based foods, we can be much healthier. This meat-centric diet that we have is not good for us by so many measures of the high rates of cancer and heart disease and high cholesterol. You know, there's no reason for us to test cosmetics on animals when we have validated alternative methods, when we can have safe ingredients and products that don't necessitate poisoning animals at very high dosage levels that would rarely mimic the risks that we would face in a natural, you know, sort of setting where we're using cosmetics. I mean, we do a lot of these things because we've been doing them a long time. We're conditioned to them, or we're simply unaware that it's going on in some laboratory or some factory farm. And we're trying to shrink the distance between our consumer choices and what is happening to animals on the ground. You know, just because, you know, we're not doing the killing when we buy, you know, a pork product that comes from a factory farm, we are morally connected to that activity through our purchasing choice. I mean, we may not have put the animal in a cage to immobilize her, and we may not have slit her throat, but we are morally connected because the only reason that confinement and killing happened is because there was a consumer on the other end demanding it. So it's very, very important that we be conscious consumers and understand that the supply chains that we are linked to, you know, really, really lead to some pretty dark places. And we should be bringing light to those places and finding out a way for our economy to hum without doing terrible things to animals.
And you've directly shown as well how humane processes are often better for the economy. So it's really that cultural change, getting people to embrace that to begin with, and then they see their bottom line embraced.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, there's a reason that Walmart and McDonald's, you know, which provide low-cost food products to the public, are changing their purchasing practices, because those people want to know that animals are not inordinately exploited. in the process of getting food to the customer. So even the biggest low-cost oriented chains and grocers are making changes, and that is really encouraging to me.
And you founded Humane USA, which is the nonpartisan political arm of the animal protection movement. You also co-founded the National Federation of Humane Societies, which is a trade association. It's principally representing your local humane societies throughout the USA. So how has your experience been founding your own organizations?
Well, you know, the group, you know, Humane USA really evolved into something called the Humane Society Legislative Fund, and the Humane Society of the U.S. is a 501c3, so we're a charitable organization. If people make a donation to us, you can get a tax deduction for doing so, essentially. But the government places limits on our political activity, so I felt like we really needed to step it up in the political realm because lawmaking for animals is so important. You know, you need standards. A small number of people who want to engage in dogfighting can create havoc for dogs. You can't necessarily convince those dogfighters to stop, but the law can speak and forbid their practice and criminalize their conduct. And, you know, founding the Humane Society Legislative Fund after I founded Humane USA was a very important tactical move, because what it spoke to is the sophistication needed to drive a social reform movement. You really need a lot of tools and tactics in order to succeed. You can't just, you know, succeed through lobbying alone. You have to work with corporations. You may need to work through the courts. You may need to, you know, really mount big, sophisticated public relations campaigns. You must do social media. We try to do it all because the challenges for animals are immense, and many of our adversaries are using those same channels and fighting on those fronts. We have to match them and ultimately exceed them and then win the argument with the public in order to drive change.
Yeah, and just about that change, young people today seem to be much more socially aware and willing and actually eager to go into nonprofit careers. So what advice would you offer to young people who are looking to pursue nonprofit careers?
Well, I would say first, it's not, you know, something unusual. 10% of all jobs in the U.S. are with nonprofit organizations. There are 1.1 million charitable organizations in the U.S. It's part of the fabric of our society. I mean, imagine a society without humane organizations or without environmental organizations or groups to drive understanding, like colleges and universities, faith-based groups. I mean, these are the pillars of our society. These are nonprofit organizations. These are charities. So it's noble work. I think that trying to make our society a better one is in the best spirit of our humanity. You know, we live, of course, you know, for, you know, satisfying some of our needs, and obviously we have the capacity for enjoying things, and that's part of who we are as individual beings. There's nothing wrong with enjoying life, but there is also something very good about doing good for others. And I think, you know, from my perspective as president of the Humane Society of the United States, I mean, I became alert to the problem of animal cruelty, and I saw it on factory farms, and I saw it in cosmetic testing laboratories, and I saw it in trophy hunting activities and dog fights and cockfights, and I decided I didn't want to be a bystander. I wanted to do something about it. And that, you know, sort of instinct, which is to change the world for the better, is the instinct collectively expressed in the past that has changed our society for the good. That process must continue, and it needs, you know, good, smart, idealistic people to populate these organizations and to grow them. And of course, you know, it's a dynamic situation. Even if you don't work for one of them, you know, you can support them with your charitable dollars or your volunteerism. So, I mean, we're all connected to charities in one way or another. And if something, you know, really moves you, if a cause moves you, then by all means, get involved. And of course, you know, one of the highest expressions is as a staff member. And a lot of young people, you know, start by doing an internship. We have internship programs, and, you know, young people come here and they get inspired and they learn things, and it's transformational in terms of their outlook.
That's such a crucial message to close our time today. Wayne, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
The best way to reach Wayne and to support the Humane Society of the United States is through humanesociety.org. Click on the webpage links above this podcast for further details.
Thank you for joining us today. Our library of interviews and a range of further resources may be found at archstreetpress.org or prx.org.